Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Australia is back on track.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
Just dumbstruck.
I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
I don't think I know.
I have no hesitation.
That should cause great concern.
Just sit down,
Mr. Sticky, your eyes!
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant.
He needs a mirror.
I mean...
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Hi, Mark Kenny here with Democracy Sausage, which comes each week from the ANU's Australian Studies Institute, the School of Politics and International Relations, and from Policy Forum at the Crawford School of Public Policy. The world's in a perilous place, it seems, with war in Europe, an ongoing pandemic, and climate-related disasters increasing in frequency, as we know all too well. While the new Labor government has attempted to inject a measure of positivity into Australia's international relations, it's clear that America, Australia's closest strategic ally, continues to turn in on itself. The isolationism and toxic division of the Trump administration seems to still be shaping US domestic politics and limiting American prestige and influence globally. As the January 6 congressional inquiry wends on, Trump's intense politicization of the Supreme Court is unveiling its full horror, leading to profound divisions and fears of a serious internal conflict. Some even say civil war or some sort of equivalent. That's our focus this week, and to do that, I'm joined by the perspicacious Dr. Maria Teflaga, as always, from the School of Politics and International Relations. Hi, Maria.
Hello, Mark. How are you?
I'm well. I'm perhaps a bit better than you are. A bit of a lurgy there we can all hear in your voice. I hope that hope you make it through. Understand if you don't.
Thank you, Mark. I'll be okay.
And it's welcome back to Dr. Jennifer Hunt, formerly of ANU and now a lecturer in security studies at Macquarie University. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's go to SCOTUS, as it's often called, the Supreme Court of the United States, to start off our discussion, because that's an area of expertise of yours. Do you agree with my characterization that Trump's pernicious influence is only now starting to find its full expression?
Well, the appointment of Supreme Court justices is one of the longest legacies of a president. And many people warned about this in 2016, that Roe was on the chopping block and potentially marriage equality, and that is proven prescient.
And when you say 2016, this was even before the election, wasn't it? Because Trump was indicating before he was elected that he was going to make appointments to the Supreme Court that were consistent with his values.
Absolutely. And in the debates, he said that women who get abortion should be punished.
Mm. And that's what they're doing now.
Exactly. So this is the first full term of that 6-3 supermajority now. And remember, the last two appointments from the Trump administration had no qualifications for this. They had never argued a case. And they now have lifetime appointments on this court and possibly a conservative supermajority until at least 2050.
So let's go to that. Who are these justices, the ones you just referred to?
So we had Amy Coney Barrett, who was appointed in the middle of the election. 60 million Americans had already voted by the time her name was put forward, even though, of course, Obama was not allowed to have a seat for a full year. That was held over by Mitch McConnell.
That's right. And the argument then was that there was a presidential changeover about to happen. And
that's right.
Therefore, and that was a year away, as
a
you
year.
Say. And the Republicans argued that it was inappropriate for the outgoing president to appoint any Supreme Court justices.
That's right, but it was somehow appropriate to appoint them after voting had already begun.
Yeah, in Trump's case, yeah.
And then, of course, before that was Brett Kavanaugh. Neither, of course, of them had ever argued a case before.
Right.
So not particularly well qualified for a lifetime appointment on this court.
No, and also, notably, in their 50s. Right?
Yes.
So quite young, with a long potential presence on the Supreme Court.
Absolutely.
And I suppose for Australian ears, and that's most of our audience, although we have people listening around the world, but and this would be the case for many people in other countries as well, just the idea of such nakedly political appointments to the judicial, you know, Supreme Court, to the top rung of the judiciary seems kind of bizarre.
Absolutely. And all tilted toward the one case that we've seen decided, Roe v. Wade. And those ramifications are going to be immense. We've already had a 10-year-old incest victim that couldn't get health care in her state and had to travel for it. You've had ectopic pregnancies that are going to risk the lives of women and are, of course, completely non-viable. And with other birth defects, anencephaly, you know, other conditions that are incompatible with life, the woman's life will be sacrificed or she'll be criminalized. In effect, every pregnancy in America is a high-risk pregnancy now.
Yeah. Maria, any thoughts on this in terms of, you know, as I say, that sort of Australian incredulity really at the, you know, we have appointments made to our judiciary, which are also political. And this is a point you've made before, Jennifer, when we've spoken about this, that, you know, governments make appointments to the High Court, for example. But it is nowhere near as partisan as this. Maria, what are your thoughts on this?
So I guess I think some of the most interesting dimensions around this from an Australian perspective is because we don't have a Bill of Rights, our relationship to our court is quite different. You know, ultimately we don't look to the courts to resolve a lot of moral politics issues because there's not really the same mechanisms or tool sets available to courts that you see in places where you do have bills of rights, like the United States or Canada, for example, when they introduced their charter in the 1980s. I'm not saying that this is like necessarily a better model or anything like that, but it does mean that legislatures have had to grapple with these issues in Australia and abortion being a sort of state-based one. But it also means that change is quite patchy across the country, right? Like there are still states where abortion has only been decriminalized, for example. It's, I think, the majority of Australian states. We do have uneven access to abortion in terms of like the ability to just simply get a procedure. And it's not listed on Medicare, which is kind of shocking if you think about it, given how essential it is. And I think the other major difference that I think a lot of Australians sort of struggle to understand is that support for abortion in Australia is well over 60%. I think the last figures have it over 70% at least. So it's a super majority. Whereas in the United States, it's sort of 48-48 with two undecided in the middle, basically, which explains why it is an ongoing issue in your country, Jennifer. But yeah, I mean, as someone looking from afar, it is it's quite shocking. And I think the thing that was also sort of quite shocking to me was not just the decision on Roe v. Wade, but about like a few days later, there was that ruling restricting the ability of the Environmental Protection Agency to, you know, have a broader remit than just looking at air pollution, I believe, which has all kinds of implications for climate change as well. And so I guess when you've got a political system that's about 270 years old and a supermajority of judges who believe that you should sort of go back to whatever the intentions of people 270 years ago, it is kind of and a situation where lots of political issues are now resolved ultimately in the courts because the political system can't manage them. It is worrying.
It is. And Jennifer, Maria raises a couple of points there that are quite interesting, I think. One is the point, reminding us the point that the court is going back to its own previous ruling in this case on Roe v. Wade, right? So it's actually revisiting a decision and overturning a precedent that's already established, which is actually quite uncommon.
Yes, very common. The court has normally expanded rights. And, of course, there are other later rulings that are built on Roe v. Wade's precedent.
Yeah. So essentially just determining that the court had it wrong 50 years ago when it when a majority of the judges were appointed by Richard Nixon, as I understand, when the original decision was made in Roe v. Wade, and when things were, as we now know, because we have the value of so much history since, we now know that what people thought was a hyper-partisan court then was nothing compared to you know, the way politics have gone in the United States and the way these appointments have gone, the way the court now conducts itself. The other interesting point, though, that Maria touched on was that at one level, all the Supreme Court has done, looking at, again, through Australian eyes, is return the US to a situation that actually obtains in Australia now, which is that the federal government doesn't decide these things and can't pass laws in relation to it. The states make those decisions themselves.
So, that's
kind of misleading, isn't it?
Because some of those states already had trigger laws in effect in which the voters have no say at this point whether.
But the court's really just deciding whether the federal government, whether the Constitution in the case of Roe v. Wade has this protection in it or it doesn't. It's sort of a jurisprudential or legal question.
Indeed. But again, those trigger laws are now enforcing 1862. Era laws in some of these states.
Right.
Which is remarkable, right? I mean,
it wasn't a good year. Think
before women could vote.
Yeah. Indeed. I mean, as I understand it, the abortion as an issue in the United States wasn't always as polarized as it is now, and that it was sort of a tactic used by some elements on the right to mobilize, groups of voters that were perhaps like less politically engaged, and this is sort of the end game of that, you know, where you've got all of these states essentially pushing through laws to create test cases, right, which now see Roe v. Wade overturned, or having like those trigger laws, as you just mentioned, on the books sort of ready to go. And I guess it kind of, to me, points to like a failure of politics, right, to like that's the whole reason we have parliaments. It's to sort of try to resolve these difficult issues on the basis of, you know, citizens' preferences and discourse. And I guess I think it is as an outsider, right? You know, to me, it sort of says that something needs to be done about the institutional settings because it's too dangerous to allow 9 people to essentially who have lifetime appointments and are now appointed in an entirely partisan and politicized process to have these decisions of life and death over, you know, 200 million women in the United States, let alone everyone else. Like, I have no idea how you fix that. But to me, it's like it speaks to a bigger set of problems than just the court.
Of course. And de Tocqueville called states laboratories of democracy. The federal government was there to underwrite minimum standards, right? Every state can have a minimum wage that is above the standard, but they can't go below it.
Right.
So there has to be some modicum of standards. And that's what the federal government is. But what we have now at the state level are laboratories of autocracy, where in this suite of decisions that the Supreme Court has made, they have now eroded the separation of church and state. They've eroded the enforcement of Miranda warnings. They've, eliminated the ability to sue violent border guards. You already mentioned the EPA's authority to regulate greenhouse gases at power plants. That's gone. They've already dismantled the Voting Rights Act in 2013, this very same court. But now there's a case pending that could see Republican legislatures at the state level overturn the will of the people to declare whomever they want the victor of elections. Mm. So I think just seeing that one case in isolation misses the point of this court. But you're correct. This was largely seen to be a Catholic issue at the time some of these laws were written. I remember going back to the Southern Baptist Convention. I grew up Baptist and reading the conventions from the 1970s where they recognized and applauded the Roe v. Wade decision because women were dying. And I think anyone who hasn't grown up ever, under Roe v. Wade is about to get an education in human reproductive biology about how this happens and how frequently this happens. But you also see that same composition in the court. You have a composition of the court that is not reflective of the United States, especially in terms of religious affiliation, a 6-3 Catholic court. And I think these cases are only going to continue, starting with that North Carolina voting case, which would see the U.S. election severely challenged moving forward.
I want to come back to that in a sec, but just sticking with the Roe v. Wade for a moment and the issue, I suppose, more specifically, and its political framing, how much of the position on abortion is really symbolic as an issue for the right in America? That is, it's because plainly we can see people who are both pro-life and pro-gun have a glaring contradiction in their political position. I think it was Arianna Huffington or someone like that tweeted the Supreme Court had in the same week framed its argument that life begins at conception and ends in a mass shooting. Graphic and shocking though that is, that appeared to be.
Absolutely. Yeah. And of course, guns are the leading cause of death for children in the United States.
Yeah,
now.
Which is astonishing. I mean, and this is supposedly, the apex first world country, and the leading cause of death for children is guns.
Absolutely. And not civilized. Not the muskets, of the originalists. Yeah.
And the muskets, of course, were the guns that were sort of around at the time that the right to bear arms was established.
For the purposes of a well-regulated militia. Be sure to read the entirety of the Second Amendment. But, an AR-15, the type of damage that does, they were having to identify some of those school children in Texas by DNA evidence.
It's just it's unfathomable. Yeah.
We just had a mass shooting on July 4th.
Yeah.
It's a daily occurrence.
Which is
now.
This morning our time. Yeah. Yes. As we record this. Yeah.
So it's clearly not an issue of doors. It was outside the parade.
What's that?
It's clearly not an issue of doors. That was the Republican.
Oh, the doors thing. Yeah. The doors about schools. Yeah.
Exactly. I need to turn them into prisons.
Well, I mean, also, fires are also a life threatening issue, and one door in and out wouldn't. This is insane. I can't believe we're even talking about this. This is stupid.
It was astonishingly stupid. But that's what they're reduced to because if your position, if your bottom line is that you are going to defend something that is absolutely indefensible on every measure, then no argument's too ridiculous to support.
But I think you're right. It's symbolic because they don't understand what life will be like under this. But it has also been the only focal point that the entire party can agree on for as long as I can remember. And they are taught that abortion is murder. There's no sophistication or nuance in their understanding of biology. And it means that miscarriages are now essentially manslaughter and they will be criminalized and investigated as such.
Hmm.
That's insane.
Let's take a quick break there and be back in just a moment.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, I'm going to raise something that's, I do with some trepidation because it's an unpleasant prospect. But I wonder what your, I'll get both of your opinions on this, what the prospect is for, I mean, given that we see these mass shootings all the time, they are very, very frequent occurrence now. We know right-wing political extremism is a growing problem in a lot of places, in the US particularly. Nut jobs could now be armed not just with an AR-15 or whatever you call it. I'm not an expert on arms, as you can tell. But they've got the Bible as well, and now they've got the Constitution, as they say, right? In the wake of this Roe v. Wade overturn. Is there a danger that we are now going to see to those corporations who came out very quickly and said any of our employees who find themselves in need of a termination can go to pro-choice states and we will pay for them? Is there a danger that those sorts of corporations who are in pro-life states, as they call themselves, could face direct action by extremists?
I think so. I mean, anti-abortion extremism was already designated as sort of a radical group on the FBI,
That's list. Right. And we know that clinics had been attacked in the past and people have been killed and there have been all kinds of tragedies.
And we know that the Supreme Court had also overturned any barriers around those facilities and their healthcare facilities. They don't just do abortions. They do healthcare screenings. They do cancer screenings. They do birth control. And so they had overturned any safe zone for women, trans, moving through that space. And I think you will see groups that feel emboldened now. And with the loosening of gun control, remember, several states have enacted permitless carry now. You need no education, no permit, no license, no training, no waiting to procure these tactical battlefield weapons. And I think that they will be looking for an opportunity to use them.
Yeah, I think it's really important that you call them tactical battlefield weapons, right? Because that is what we're talking about here, right? Like, I have a really provocative question for you, Jennifer. I mean, whenever anyone brings up the United States, like if I'm at a barbecue or whatever, like it's not long before people start talking about whether or not the United States will actually be a state in 10 or 15 years. Someone commented to me the other day that you've sort of, with the Roe v. Wade decision, you've now got a fundamental question of the right to life that is treated in like drastically different ways in different jurisdictions across the country. I mean, I don't know.
For the first time since slavery, really.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Exactly. That was exactly the context in which the point was made. Is this hyperbole?
No. I think sadly, if you look at the indicators of a failing state, the U.S. ticks some fairly dangerous boxes. And it's nowhere more dangerous than to women. I've had lots of conversations with people in the United States about where to send their children to school, to college, and to university. Mm. And this being a key consideration, will they really receive medical care when it's required, or will some rapist in that state decide they want to select the mother of their children?
What a an outrageous proposition.
What do you think the impact will be on the midterms? I mean, realistically, what can the federal government really do to address this? I mean, what can the political system do apart from, hope that a justice passes away so they can be replaced? I mean, I think our audience would if you do know that answer, like, that would be helpful.
Yeah, and just before we go to that, I mean, can I add just one other aspect to that question? And that is the possibility, however faint, of expanding the Supreme Court, which was one of the options that was being talked about for a while, which could change the balance. So on top of what Maria was asking.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's probably the easiest one to start with. There is no mention of the number of justices in the Constitution, in the sacred document. It has been fewer. It's been more. It's currently 9 because there were 9 district courts, 9 circuit courts when they were developing that number. We have now 13 circuit courts in the United States, not 9. So I think that's an excellent starting point for a rationale. During the New Deal, FDR threatened to expand the court if they didn't get into line with some of his progressive measures. And so that wasn't a necessary step that had to be taken in the end. I'm not sure that Biden has that sort of intimidation factor that FDR had.
The kahunas for it.
But I do think expanding, rebalancing the court is an increasingly popular option.
But that would just be seen for the political act it was, wouldn't it, by the right? They would see it as, hang on, we won the presidency, we filled the vacancies, we operated as the rules allowed, and you are now just rigging the rules in your favour, which is, descent into more chaos.
Well, if Mitch McConnell says that would be rich, because he obviously didn't abide by the rules by keeping that seat open in the first place for a year, in keeping 400 pieces of legislation that had been passed by the House, weren't even given a hearing in the Senate. So if we want to talk about rules and norms, I would have to say that the Republican Party has not found itself, considered itself bound by those for quite a time.
Nor reason. I mean, that's a reasoned argument. That will be water off a duck's back, right?
I mean, incredibly, this sort of sounds like the House of Lords, right, in the United Kingdom, right, the House of the aristocracy, and the way that ultimately the Commons asserted its ability or its control, or its, control's the wrong word, its dominance in the political system was to stare down the Lords and sometimes to pack it, right? I know I like to make this point a lot, but it really does sort of show that the machinery of government in the United States really is from another kind of time. Like, its logics are kind of very different to, I guess, how you would design a democratic state today if you were starting afresh.
Yeah.
It's true. It's a very aged document. This is 1789. It was quite progressive for its time. And we have amended it several times to, accommodate Indeed. Modern circumstances. But I think it's the interpretation that has proven itself dangerous by partisans.
Yeah.
Not the Constitution's fault.
Precisely. But it's trapped by this document in a sense, because it delimits what is able to be done. But as you say, it's a progressive document at its time. It's able to be interpreted and reinterpreted, as we've seen. But that becomes a very political exercise. And that's now the battleground all the time, isn't it?
Absolutely.
How about the Republican Party itself, the GOP? It seems to be a party that is in rapid descent from anything approximating the Democratic institution that it used to be, that it's been at its best anyway.
Yes, Norm Ornstein called it an insurgent outlier, that it's unpersuaded by facts and evidence and doesn't recognize the authority of any opposing party to govern. Right. And that was 10 years ago.
Right. And you didn't even read that. You just said that, just rolled off the top. Because, yes, and it's as cogent an explanation as I think there is. But as you say, that was 10 years ago, and that's become even more pressing since. Can I just read the lead from a New York Post article? This is how it goes. Disgraced former Missouri governor and GOP Senate candidate Eric Greitens, is that his correct pronunciation?
Yes.
Yep. Released a wild ad Monday calling on primary voters to order a, quote, RINO, that is RINO, hunting permit, in an attack on Republicans known for breaking with former President Donald Trump. So he was clearly targeting people like Liz Cheney, who mm-hmm. are now seen as, you know, figures of great hatred on the religious right,
disloyal.
On the pro-gun right. Yeah, as disloyal, as a traitor, everything else. And pretty clearly the imagery in that ad where he's holding a shotgun, he's flanked by men in fatigues, mm-hmm. Holding assault weapons. This is a mainstream candidate. I mean, transpose these conditions to Australia. It is unthinkable, right? That's the
absolutely
the idea that this guy is effectively calling to arms for the purpose of getting a permit so you can assassinate Republicans, people who are Rhino Republican in name only, because they are what doing the bidding of the left or whatever it is.
Absolutely, and he's encouraging people with that, you know, to get your own hunting license. He is giving them permission.
Yeah.
And, you know, from the Australian perspective, I teach research methods in security studies and looking at, you know, visual data. Campaign ads are a great example of the kinds of narratives and visuals and other sorts of data that we can glean and themes we can glean from visual data. So in my class, I pull up three political campaign ads from the United States that I'm sure they haven't seen. I assume they haven't seen. But before I do so, I have them make a list. What do you expect to see in a political ad? What do you expect to see from someone who's vying for leadership? And they always come up, these are postcards, come up, you know, judgment, policies, temperament, credentials, right? Mm. But what they get when I show them these ads of Republicans is them blowing up a car marked with the word socialism. And they're just flabbergasted. They're like, this cannot be real. And like, all of those people were elected. These aren't fringe candidates. These are all elected officials. Mm. And this is the type of narrative and discourse and sort of violent imagery that is becoming increasingly mainstream in the Republican Party.
I mean, what do they want? What's their ideal state look like?
They do not consider anyone else real Americans. They're very clear about that. So they call themselves patriots because they truly believe it, that they are the only legitimate voice of the country, and thus their opinions and power and policies must be upheld, regardless of whether they constitute the majority or the minority, and they are definitely the minority.
Do you see any of these tendencies creeping into Australia? I mean, I'll give you an example, and it's a bit of a sensitive one because I don't want to appear to in any way be devaluing the feelings of the people that were being expressed here, nor the loss that they felt. But when the Labor Senator Kimberly Kitching died of a heart attack, there was an outpouring of grief across the political aisle, and a number of people described her straight up as a patriot at the time. And it struck me as an odd thing to say because it's almost like in contradistinction other people aren't, which felt to me like a tendency you see in American politics a bit, and which goes to the point you were just making about who are the real Americans and who aren't. And there are, of course, other things. That's just a linguistic one, I suppose. But there are lots of other sort of tendencies we've seen maybe even in Clive Palmer's ads. Although I must admit, when you were talking about, you know, blowing up cars with socialism written on them or the ad that I was just talking about, it's a long way from risible photos of Craig Kelly with our next PM written underneath it. That was just comic. A waste of money, but good for media companies who made a lot of money out of it. But yeah, so do you see any of these tendencies in Australian politics or in other Western countries?
I tend to notice the narratives that creep in around, like you said, patriotism or tyranny. I've heard a few mentions of that in the anti-vax community. This is, you know, medical tyranny. And also, I saw various attempts under the Scott Morrison government to introduce this exalted position of the military. He would do the welcome to country and then I'd like to thank our troops. That's very American.
Yes, very good point. I've felt that too. Yeah.
You haven't been in an American airport until the troops have been thanked every half hour on the half hour over the loud speaker. So,
and Trump had lots of military people in his administration, didn't he? For a while there's several generals, you know, sort of kicking around the West Wing.
Absolutely. Well, they're known for being quite hierarchical. They tend to listen when their commander in chief says something.
Or throws lunch at them.
Exactly. But military personnel, retired or non-active, are overrepresented in representative government in the United States at every level. There seem to be leaders. There seem to be, you know, good judgment, courage under fire, that sort of thing. They have a very high reputation. In fact, according to the Pew survey, I think I last looked at this in 2016, it was the only cohort in which the American has high trust across the partisan spectrum. There is no other group that has that kind of, not the courts, not law enforcement, and definitely not each other.
It's not like that here, is it, Maria?
Look, I do think that there are always, and I think the internet has sort of certainly helped, right? Like, you know, do you remember when Old Parliament House was burnt down? Well, some of the arguments around that were like this sort of fringe sovereign citizens movement, right? And these were left-wing people who burnt down the entranceway to Old Parliament House, essentially importing a crazy idea from the sort of netherworld of the American fringe around, you know, basically declaring sovereignty within yourself as a way of rejecting the control of the sovereignty of the state. Anyway, that's really not how that works.
The living soul.
Exactly. But I do think this conversation around patriotism is really interesting in Australia. Like, yes, you know, the coalition very much, it's like since Abbott was elected, like if you recall, like he really made a thing about flags, having flags and being depicted with flags. And as time went on, as his prime ministership got into more and more trouble, more and more flags kind of
I think it got
appeared.
To nine at one stage.
Yeah, it was a linear relationship, you know. And we've certainly seen like the militarization of lots of policy responses under the Morrison government. And if you recall, one of the things he said, one of his few regrets was that he didn't bring the military in earlier to manage the vaccine rollout. Not that he regretted trying to politicize the rollout by using the bits of government he controlled so he could take credit rather than allowing the states to do what they're actually good at, which is running health systems, right? So, yeah, and, you know, and like the Governor General is more often than not a military figure these days, you know. So there's definitely a sort of veneration around that from the coalition. You know, if you look at the Brereton report, like that was a difficult issue for the government to kind of manage. But and I think that kind of goes hand in hand with, you know, Labor until very, very recently has sort of ceded patriotism to the right and had done so for a generation, which is kind of incredible because, you know, I mean, like, where did Labor kind of start? Like, you know, Australia for the working man, Australia for the white man, you know, Australia for Australians. And I guess because we've had these social reckonings around rights movements for women, for Indigenous people, for you know, non-heterosexual people, so much of what the left has had to sort of say about the Australian state for, I don't know, a good 50 years has been one of, you know, critique, right? Critique outside of like the classical kind of class, material, political kind of critique of the Australian state. And so Labor has sort of kind of ceded that ground. But I actually think it's really interesting that a lot of politicians within Labor on both from both the left and right factions are kind of saying that we need to reclaim the politics of patriotism. And we need to find like a positive way of talking about Australia because it is kind of alienating. And whilst I do think that we do import many cross currents from the United States, I do have hope that we won't have quite the same outcome, essentially for two reasons. One is we're not an empire and the United States is. And that sort of discussion of the military, like if you look at all empires, they all kind of do this, like in their own kind of way. You know, the United Kingdom still has like a lot of overhangs around this. Like there's that Queen's Conference concert every year with the military, for example. Like that's, you know, that's like one thing, like the way Russia celebrates its military, like it's just on a different scale to what we do here. So we don't have that kind of empire dimension. And two, you know, we could be getting to a sort of situation where our leading left-wing parties are finding a new way to sort of celebrate the nation. And I think The Voice and the stuff around the Uluru Statement is one pathway down that avenue. So it'd be really interesting to kind of see.
Well, that's a really interesting point, actually, and I guess we'll have to look at that in another podcast quite separately, because it deserves attention all on its own, of course, as a question and all of the issues around that, and whether it can be successfully progressed and where the Greens fit in, and a whole range of questions come up about that. Just going back to the GOP for a bit before we conclude. I'm just wondering whether because there's a question about whether the union can survive the current tensions that it has. And there's also obviously a subsidiary question, but an important one, about whether the GOP can survive within that, because it is both the agent or the vehicle for these tensions pulling apart at, straining the union itself. And as we've noted, no arguments seem to be too ridiculous. We had the reality, actually, of General Flynn, Michael Flynn, being questioned by the aforementioned Liz Cheney. I don't know if people have seen this. You can see it on Twitter and various other places, but it is astonishing because she's asking him. He's sitting there with it's done by video conference, Skype or whatever, and she's asking him some pretty basic questions. He's got his lawyer next to him, and when she asks him, does he believe in the orderly transfer of power after an election, he takes the Fifth. He takes the Fifth Amendment on that question. Does he believe the insurrection at the Capitol, the riot at the Capitol, was a good or a bad thing? He takes the Fifth, and several other sort of basic questions. I mean, that strikes me. If Republicans can put up with those kinds of contradictions, then it raises questions. As Marie was saying before, I think about the kind of country the US is and Australia's alliance to it, and that raises to me the question about Australia's relationship with the US, because one of the things we always say, and I've been to the US many times with prime ministers and so forth, it's always stressed that we share common values. Well, do we share common values if we look at Roe v. Wade, or if we look at the question of the treatment of life in relation to guns, as we've been discussing, if we look at the commitment to democracy, which seems to be extremely tenuous in a very significant, very powerful section of the American community. Do we share the same values? Is this in danger of coming apart?
Well, definitely. If there's confusion about commitment to the peaceful transfer of power, a key tenet of democracy.
Yeah,
it's very,
about as fundamental as it gets.
It's very hard to see how the Republican Party moves forward with the Democratic Party or any other party in the United States as a unified union. And I remember, during the insurrection, which we all watched live, the world watched live on television, although, of course, Susan Collins still thought it was Iran. She wrote an op-ed about that.
She thought it was what?
She thought it was Iran attacking.
Oh, did she?
She did. And she pinned that under her own name in her local newspaper. When this attack happened, I assume Iran was following through on its threats.
Right.
Oh, my God.
The danger was a little closer to home.
But what stuck out to me watching it live is when they tore down the U.S. flag and replaced it with a Trump flag.
Yeah, which you would think, I hate to sort of play on words here, but you'd think that would be a red flag for Republicans.
Exactly. Or the fact that they were chaining, hang Mike Pence, one of their own, as they were constructing a gallows outside. But
yeah.
Apparently that's beside the point. and there's a great photo now that we have as a result of the hearings of Mike Pence reading Trump's tweet, sort of encouraging the mob while he is sort of in lockdown in the building.
Mm.
Awaiting what happens next. But I don't know if you've been following these hearings, Mark.
Not as assiduously as you, I suspect.
But someone asked me what they're for. And I think they're for posterity, but they're also for accountability. And these people are under oath, as you mentioned. And that's why we see some of them talking out of, both sides of their mouths during December and January and February. And now saying something totally different, obviously there is no election fraud now that I'm under oath and there are penalties attached to lying, just like you have to have evidence in a court of law, which is why Trump's 60 court cases failed. But I think their commitment to democracy was already evident, or lack of, when the same day as the insurrection, 200 Republicans voted against certifying the results
Yes.
of ballots that they themselves were on. Mm. You know, it's not like in Australia where you get two pages, two different ballots, whether it's the House or the Senate. It's all on one page. Their names were right alongside the president's on that list. And so if they will undermine the integrity of the ballots on which they themselves are named, I think it's a very dire forecast for upcoming elections.
I remember we had a visitor from the United States who is a political sociologist, and he presented some pretty alarming data. And one of the things he said that has always sort of stuck with me was that some of his respondents, he was sort of wealthy, high wealth individuals who voted Republican, and they basically said that, you know, to explain their political views was that America was not a democracy, it was a republic. And looking at some of the ways in which voters' rights are systematically undermined across the country, it does look like a country that actually has a pretty shaky commitment to democracy in a way that is really striking to Australians, where, of course, we must vote and where our electoral commission is empowered and required basically to bend over backwards to make it as easy as possible.
Absolutely. Oh, just one last point on the hearings, so we can sort of going back to the beginning of our conversation, the other sort of insight from these hearings has been the link to the Supreme Court, which is what we started our conversation about, that Jenny Thomas, the wife of one of the Supreme Court, was involved in the rally, in communicating with lawmakers to overturn the elections. And remember that her husband, Justice Thomas, was the only justice in an 8-1 decision that ruled to withhold White House documents from the January 6th committee that's hearing now.
Right. And of course, he's the justice that has also raised the prospect of revisiting same-sex marriage.
Yes, contraception.
Yep.
But not, you know, Loving versus Virginia, which is interracial marriage, because he's in one of those.
Right. But, yes, indeed.
But all of those cases, as you mentioned, are tied together with Roe under the right to privacy and the expansion of individual rights.
And, you know, the role of religion in all of this is, the pernicious role of religion in all this is, can't be overstated. I don't know how credible this dude is, but his name's Nick Fuentes, and he was saying he's a sort of a white Christian broadcaster, and he was saying on his poisonous program that what did he say? That anyone who doesn't serve Jesus Christ, and this was sort of basically said against Jews, so it was an anti-Semitic comment, anyone who doesn't serve Jesus Christ should not be allowed to hold public office in the United States.
Yeah, shocking. Well, shall have no religious test. I remember we wrote that one down too.
Yeah.
But this was on the back of Jewish people saying that, well, the right to abortion is part of our religious beliefs, right? So religious freedom is religious pluralism. Otherwise, it's just sparkling theocracy.
Exactly.
And
beautifully put.
So the whole point, the place was started.
And so this was an attempt to undermine the narrative that, and I believe it was him or somebody similar, that said, well, that doesn't really matter. That's not a real religion because they don't have a pope. They don't have that centralized authority. Judaism is too fractured to be a real religion. And that is a terrifying statement.
Indeed, it is a terrifying statement to end on. thanks. It's been wonderful having you here again, Jen.
Thank you.
Really terrific. And thank you to you, Maria, with your lurgy. You've made it through.
We'll have to talk about some good news sometimes, Mark.
Yeah, we will. Is there some good news? Come back
to
me.
Someone suggested on my business card, you know, Jennifer Hunt, political scientist, it should say charming and alarming. You know?
Yeah. That's good. That's very good. I would go with that. I would go with that. Thank you, Maria.
My pleasure.
And thank you, Jennifer. And that's all for Democracy Sausage this week. I hope you've enjoyed it or endured it. Obviously, some bleak material, but also great food for thought, no doubt.
Right. So we're thankful to live in a country where we have voting rights, universal health care, and gun control.
It's a very good point, isn't it? I know I'm just extending things now, but I'm just trying to. Yes, Robert Reich. He covered this very, very beautifully in a tweet. He said, forced birth control in a country with no universal health care, no universal childcare, no paid family and medical leave, one of the highest rates of maternal mortality among rich nations. This isn't about life, it's about control. And I thought, pretty well put. Yep. Anyway, on that grim note, that's Democracy Sausage for this week. Thank you. Bye.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.